Chapter 9. His arrival, instead of a holy babe? I wish to know why haste was made to stick those pins all over his innocent form, in every direction. I wish to be informed why light and air are excluded from Augustus George, like poisons. Why, I ask, is my unoffending infant so etched into a basket bedstead, with dimity and calico, with miniature sheets and blankets, that I can only hear him snuffle and no wonder. Deep down under the pink hood of a little bathing machine, and can never peruse even so much of his lineaments as his nose? Was I expected to be the father of a French roll, that the brushes of all nations were laid in, to rasp Augustus George? Am I to be told that his sensitive skin was ever intended by nature to have rashes brought out upon it by the premature and incessant use of those formidable little instruments? Is my son a nutmeg, that he is to be grated on the stiff edges of sharp frills? Am I the parent of a muslin boy, that his yielding surfaces to be crimped and small-plated? Or is my child composed of paper or of linen, that impressions of the finer getting-up art, practiced by the laundress, are to be printed off, all over his soft arms and legs, as I constantly observe them? The starch enters his soul. Who can wonder that he cries? Was Augustus George intended to have limbs, or to be born a torso? I presume that limbs were the intention, as they are the usual practice. Then, why are my poor child's limbs fettered and tied up? Am I to be told that there is any analogy between Augustus George Meek and Jack Shepherd? Analyze castor oil at any institution of chemistry that may be agreed upon, and inform me what resemblance, in taste, it bears to that natural provision which it is at once the pride and duty of Maria Jane to administer to Augustus George. Yet, I charge Mrs. Prodgett, aided and abetted by Mrs. Bigby, with systematically forcing castor oil on my innocent son, from the first hour of his birth. When that medicine, in its sufficient action, causes internal disturbance to Augustus George, I charge Mrs. Prodgett, aided and abetted by Mrs. Bigby, with insanely and inconsistently administering opium, to allay the storm she has raised. What is the meaning of this? If the days of Egyptian mummies are past, how dare Mrs. Prodgett require, for the use of my son, an amount of flannel and linen that would carpet my humble roof? Do I wonder that she requires it? No. This morning, within an hour, I beheld this agonizing sight. I beheld my son Augustus George in Mrs. Prodgett's hands, and on Mrs. Prodgett's knee, being dressed. He was at the moment, comparatively speaking, in a state of nature, having nothing on but an extremely short shirt, remarkably disproportionate to the length of his usual outer garments. Trailing from Mrs. Prodgett's lap, on the floor, was a long narrow roller or bandage, I should say, of several yards in extent. In this, I saw Mrs. Prodgett tightly roll the body of my unoffending infant, turning him over and over, now presenting his unconscious face upwards, now the back of his bald head, until the unnatural feat was accomplished, and the bandage secured by a pin, which I have every reason to believe entered the body of my only child. In this tourniquet, he passes the present phase of his existence. Can I know it, and smile? I fear I have been betrayed into expressing myself warmly, but I feel deeply. Not for myself, for Augustus George. I dare not interfere. Will anyone? Will any publication? Any doctor? Any parent? Anybody? I do not complain that Mrs. Prodgett, aided and abetted by Mrs. Bigby, entirely alienates Maria Jane's affections from me, and interposes an impassable barrier between us. I do not complain of being made of no account. I do not want to be of any account. But, Augustus George is a production of nature, I cannot think otherwise, and I claim that he should be treated with some remote reference to nature. In my opinion, Mrs. Prodgett is, from first to last, a convention and a superstition. Are all the faculty afraid of Mrs. Prodgett? If not, why don't they take her in hand and improve her? P.S. Maria Jane's mama boasts of her own knowledge of the subject, and says she brought up 7 children besides Maria Jane. But how do I know that she might not have brought them up much better? Maria Jane herself is far from strong, and is subject to headaches, and nervous indigestion. Besides which, I learn from the statistical tables that 1 child in 5 dies within the first year of its life, and 1 child in 3 within the 5th. That don't look as if we could never improve in these particulars, I think. P.P. S. Augustus George is in convulsions. Lying awake, my uncle lay with his eyes half closed, and his nightcap drawn almost down to his nose. His fancy was already wandering, and began to mingle up the present scene with the crater of Vesuvius, the French opera, the Colosseum at Rome, Dolly's chop house in London, and all the farrago of noted places with which the brain of a traveler is crammed. In a word, he was just falling asleep. Apostrophe thus, that delightful writer, Washington Irving, in his Tales of a Traveler. But, it happened to me the other night to be lying. Not with my eyes half closed, but with my eyes wide open. Not with my nightcap drawn almost down to my nose, for on sanitary principles I never wear a nightcap. But with my hair pitchforked, and tousled all over the pillow. Not just falling asleep by any means, but glaringly, persistently, and obstinately, broad awake. Perhaps, with no scientific intention or invention, I was illustrating the theory of the duality of the brain. Perhaps one part of my brain, being wakeful, sat up to watch the other part which was sleepy. Be that as it may, something in me was as desirous to go to sleep as it possibly could be, but something else in me would not go to sleep, and was as obstinate as George III. Thinking of George III, for I devote this paper to my train of thoughts as I lay awake. Most people lying awake sometimes, and having some interest in the subject, put me in mind of Benjamin Franklin, and so Benjamin Franklin's paper on the art of procuring pleasant dreams, which would seem necessarily to include the art of going to sleep, came into my head. Now, as I often used to read that paper when I was a very small boy, and as I recollect everything I read then as perfectly as I forget everything I read now, I quoted, "Get out of bed, beat up and turn your pillow, shake the bedclothes well with at least 20 shakes, then throw the bed open, and leave it to cool. In the meanwhile, continuing undressed, walk about your chamber. When you begin to feel the cold air unpleasant, then return to your bed, and you will soon fall asleep, and your sleep will be sweet and pleasant." Apostrophe not a bit of it. I performed the whole ceremony, and if it were possible for me to be more saucer-eyed than I was before, that was the only result that came of it. Except Niagara. The 2 quotations from Washington Irving and Benjamin Franklin may have put it in my head by an American association of ideas, but there I was, and the horseshoe fall was thundering and tumbling in my eyes and ears, and the very rainbows that I left upon the spray, when I really did last look upon it, were beautiful to see. The nightlight being quite as plain, however, and sleep seeming to be many thousand miles further off than Niagara, I made up my mind to think a little about sleep, which I no sooner did than I whirled off in spite of myself to Drury Lane Theatre, and there saw a great actor, and dear friend of mine, whom I had been thinking of in the day, playing Macbeth, and heard him apostrophizing the death of each day's life, apostrophe as I have heard him many a time, in the days that are gone. But, sleep. I will think about sleep. I am determined to think. This is the way I went on, about sleep. I must hold the word sleep, tight and fast, or I shall be off at a tangent in half a second. I feel myself unaccountably straying, already, into Clare Market. Sleep. It would be curious, as illustrating the equality of sleep, to inquire how many of its phenomena are common to all classes, to all degrees of wealth and poverty, to every grade of education and ignorance. Here, for example, is Her Majesty Queen Victoria in her palace, this present blessed night, and here is Winking Charlie, a sturdy vagrant, in one of Her Majesty's jails. Her Majesty has fallen, many thousands of times, from that same tower, which I claim a right, to tumble off now and then. So has Winking Charlie. Her Majesty in her sleep has opened her prorogued parliament, or has held a drawing room, attired in some very scanty dress, the deficiencies and improprieties of which have caused her great uneasiness. I, in my degree, have suffered unspeakable agitation of mind from taking the chair at a public dinner at the London Tavern in my night clothes, which not all the courtesy of my kind friend and host Mr. Bath could persuade me were quite adapted to the occasion. Winking Charlie has been repeatedly tried in a worse condition. Her Majesty is no stranger to a vulgar firmament, of a sort of floor cloth, with an indistinct pattern distantly resembling eyes, which occasionally obtrudes itself on her repose. Neither am one. Neither is Winking Charlie. It is quite common to all three of us to skim along with airy strides a little above the ground. Also to hold, with the deepest interest, dialogues with various people, all represented by ourselves, and to be at our wits' end to know what they are going to tell us, and to be indescribably astonished by the secrets they disclose. It is probable that we have all three committed murders and hidden bodies. It is pretty certain that we have all desperately wanted to cry out, and have had no voice. That we have all gone to the play, and not been able to get in. That we have all dreamed much more of our youth than of our later lives. That I have lost it. The thread's broken. And up I go. I, lying here with the nightlight before me, up I go, for no reason on earth, that I can find out, and drawn by no links, that are visible to me, up the great Saint Bernard. I have lived in Switzerland, and rambled among the mountains. But, why I should go there now, and why up the great Saint Bernard in preference to any other mountain, I have no idea. As I lie here broad awake, and with every sense so sharpened, that I can distinctly hear distant noises inaudible to me at another time, I make that journey, as I really did, on the same summer day, with the same happy party Two's instead, I grieve to think, and there is the same track, with the same black wooden arms to point the way, and there are the same storm refuges here and there, and there is the same snow falling at the top, and there are the same frosty mists, and there is the same intensely cold convent with its menagerie smell, and the same breed of dogs fast dying out, and the same breed of jolly young monks whom I mourn to know as humbugs. And the same convent parlor with its piano, and the sitting round the fire, and the same supper, and the same lone night in a cell, and the same bright fresh morning, when going out into the highly rarefied air was like a plunge into an icy bath. Now, see here what comes along, and why does this thing stalk into my mind on the top of a Swiss mountain? It is a figure that I once saw, just after dark, chalked upon the door in a little back lane near a country church, my first church. How young a child I may have been at the time I don't know, but it horrified me so intensely in connection with the churchyard, I suppose, for it smokes a pipe, and has a big hat with each of its ears sticking out in a horizontal line under the brim, and is not in itself more oppressive than a mouth from ear to ear, a pair of goggle eyes, and hands like two bunches of carrots, five in each. Can make it, that it is still vaguely alarming to me to recall, as I have often done before, lying awake, the running home, the looking behind, the horror, of its following me. Though whether disconnected from the door, or door and all, I can't say, and perhaps never could. It lays a disagreeable train. I must resolve to think of something on the voluntary principle. The balloon ascents of this last season. They will do to think about, while I lie awake, as well as anything else. I must hold them tight though, for I feel them sliding away, and in their stead are the Mannings, husband and wife, hanging on the top of Horsemonger Lane Jail. In connection with which dismal spectacle, I recall this curious fantasy of the mind. that, having beheld that execution, and having left those two forms dangling on the top of the entrance gateway, the man's, a limp, loose suit of clothes, as if the man had gone out of them, the woman's, a fine shape, so elaborately corseted and artfully dressed, that it was quite unchanged in its trim appearance as it slowly swung from side to side. I never could, by my uttermost efforts, for some weeks, present the outside of that prison to myself which the terrible impression I had received continually obliged me to do, without presenting it with the two figures still hanging in the morning air. Until, strolling past the gloomy place one night, when the street was deserted and quiet, and actually seeing that the bodies were not there, my fancy was persuaded, as it were, to take them down, and bury them within the precincts of the jail, where they have lain ever since. The balloon ascents of last season. Let me reckon them up. There were the horse, the bull, the parachute, and the tumbler hanging on chiefly by his toes, I believe below the car. Very wrong, indeed, and decidedly to be stopped. But, in connection with these and similar dangerous exhibitions, it strikes me that that portion of the public whom they entertain is unjustly reproached. Their pleasure is in the difficulty overcome. They are a public of great faith, and are quite confident that the gentleman will not fall off the horse, or the lady off the bull, or out of the parachute, and that the tumbler has a firm hold with his toes. They do not go to see the adventurer vanquished, but triumphant. There is no parallel in public combats between men and beasts, because nobody can answer for the particular beast, unless it were always the same beast, in which case it would be a mere stage show, which the same public would go in the same state of mind to see, entirely believing in the brute being beforehand safely subdued by the man. That they are not accustomed to calculate hazards and dangers with any nicety, we may know from their rash exposure of themselves in overcrowded steamboats, and unsafe conveyances and places of all kinds. And I cannot help thinking that instead of railing and attributing savage motives to a people naturally well disposed and humane, it is better to teach them and lead them argumentatively and reasonably, for they are very reasonable, if you will discuss a matter with them to more considerate and wise conclusions. This is a disagreeable intrusion. Here is a man with his throat cut, dashing towards me as I lie awake. A recollection of an old story of a kinsman of mine, who, going home one foggy winter night to Hampstead, when London was much smaller, and the road lonesome, suddenly encountered such a figure rushing past him, and presently two keepers from a madhouse in pursuit. A very unpleasant creature indeed, to come into my mind unbidden, as I lie awake. The balloon ascents of last season. I must return to the balloons. Why did the bleeding man start out of them? Never mind. If I inquire, he will be back again. The balloons. This particular public have inherently a great pleasure in the contemplation of physical difficulties overcome, mainly, as I take it, because the lives of a large majority of them are exceedingly monotonous and real, and further, are a struggle against continual difficulties, and further still, because anything in the form of accidental injury, or any kind of illness or disability is so very serious in their own sphere. I will explain this seeming paradox of mine. Take the case of a Christmas pantomime. Surely nobody supposes that the young mother in the pit who falls into fits of laughter when the baby is boiled or sat upon would be at all diverted by such an occurrence off the stage. Nor is the decent workman in the gallery, who is transported beyond the ignorant present by the delight with which he sees a stout gentleman pushed out of a two pair of stairs window, to be slandered by the suspicion that he would be in the least entertained by such a spectacle in any street in London, Paris, or New York. It always appears to me that the secret of this enjoyment lies in the temporary superiority to the common hazards and mischances of life, in seeing casualties, attended when they really occur with bodily and mental suffering, tears, and poverty, happened through a very rough sort of poetry without the least harm being done to anyone, the pretense of distress in a pantomime being so broadly humorous as to be no pretense at all. Much as in the comic fiction I can understand the mother with a very vulnerable baby at home, greatly relishing the invulnerable baby on the stage, so in the Kremern Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.